Welcome to Trinity Talk. I'm your host, Yuri Brito. On this episode, I'm delighted to have with us David Koizis. David is someone that I hope our audience will become familiar with. You can find some of David's works on First Things, and I have benefited greatly from David. So David, I want to thank you for your labors, for your writings, for your passion for the Genevan Psalter, a passion that I share with you. But in order to introduce yourself to our audience, give us a little bit of your own background, your academic background, a little bit of who you are to the Trinity Talk folks who are listening.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Yuri. My name is David Koizis, as you indicated, and I teach political science at Redeemer University College, and I have been there since 1987. I have a doctorate degree from the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, and I am the author of two books, Political Visions and Illusions, which was published by InterVarsity Press just over a decade ago, and most recently, We Answer to Another, Authority, Office, and the Image of God. I live in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, with my wife and daughter, and we are members of Central Presbyterian Church, a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in Canada that's 175 years old. It's a very old congregation, one of the earliest in the city.
Thank you, David, for that introduction. David, as I have interviewed many authors in the past, one thing I've realized is that unlike God's creation, books are not born ex nihilo. There is always a history behind books, and I'm always curious to know what kind of context or what led an author to write on a particular topic, because it reveals a lot about the nature of the subject. And so I want to ask you to give us a sort of a background. What led you to write on the topic of authority in particular in your latest book?
Oh, well, it actually started quite some time ago. It started 30 years ago when I was writing my dissertation. My dissertation was a comparison of the political theories of two thinkers, Herman Dooyeweerd, who was a Dutch Reformed Neo-Calvinist philosopher and jurisprudential philosopher, really, and Yves-René Simon, who was a Roman Catholic in the Neo-Thomist tradition of Jacques Maritain and Étienne Gilson and a number of others. And Simon wrote quite extensively on authority. And he wrote a book called, the Thomas Aquinas lectures at Marquette University in Milwaukee, they were eventually published, this is in 1940, as The Nature and Functions of Authority. That was the title of the small book. And then later on in 1951, he published a book called Philosophy of Democratic Government. And then in 1962, a posthumously published book, A General Theory of Authority, was published. And so Simon was somebody whom I found good basis for making a comparison between Roman Catholic and Reformed Christian approaches to political authority in particular, but other kinds of authority as well. So during my last year at Notre Dame, before I went to teach at Redeemer University College in Canada, I taught four first-year seminar courses on authority, and I had my students reading a number of different books on authority, including Simon's books, also Robert Bolt's famous play A Man for All Seasons about the life and death of Sir Thomas More. And so this is something that I was interested in already in the mid-1980s. I didn't exactly put it aside, but in the 90s, I started writing my book that would eventually become Political Visions and Illusions, that was published by InterVarsity Press. And that book was an examination of contemporary political ideologies from a Christian standpoint. And when I finished that book, it struck me that a lot of the issues concerning political ideologies and political life in general revolved around issues of authority. And so I came back to that. And in 2004, I began to research this topic in a more concentrated way. So I was really coming back after 20 years to an interest that had that had preoccupied me at Notre Dame. I began writing this in the middle of the last decade. I lost quite a bit of momentum because I had some medical issues between about 2005 and 2010 that slowed me down rather considerably. But after those were resolved, then I was quickly able to recover my momentum and to complete the book. in 2011, and then it was published just in March of this year. But issues of authority have struck me as being terribly important. I mean, Christians believe in biblical authority. Depending on which Christian tradition you are a part of, there may also be the authority of the church magisterium. However, that's understood, whether it's in the Eastern Orthodox sense of an ecumenical council, or whether it's in the Roman Catholic Church or the papacy. I mean, these are the sorts of issues that divided Christians in the 16th century, and we've been arguing about authority ever since. Although it's often not articulated in those terms. So we may speak about freedom. We may speak about the place of nation in the life of a people. We may speak about the state, and of course in the United States and in other countries right now, the principal debates that take place are precisely about what government ought and ought not to be doing. And some people take a more restrictive view of what government ought to be doing. Others take a more expansive view of that. And all of those have to do with authority and the limits within which authority should properly function. So authority is a huge issue, and I don't pretend that my book has even begun to probe beneath the surface of everything that's to be said about authority. But what I have tried to do in my book is to make a defense of authority, but a defense of authority on the basis that it is tantamount to humanity. This is as human beings, we possess authority, not of our own accord, and not because we have been so clever and everything, but everything we have comes from God Himself. And so insofar as we have authority, as a grant from a gracious God who is sovereign over the whole of His creation, including our lives.
Thank you, David, for that context. David, let me get you to interact with a couple of books that have come out recently on the topic of authority, and perhaps please give us some insight into any other major books that you have interacted with in your new book. One of the books is Andy Crouch's Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. And the other, from a very different perspective, by an acquaintance of mine, Doug Jones, who wrote Dismissing Jesus, How We Evade the Way of the Cross. Have you interacted with any of these books? And can you tell us if you've interacted with any major publications on the topic of authority?
Well, I've read Crouch's Playing God, although his book was published shortly before mine, and certainly after I completed writing my book. So no, I don't interact with Crouch's book in my book. Crouch did speak at Redeemer this past winter, and a number of us had the opportunity to talk with him during his stay. I found him a very engaging person, and personally very approachable. I think our respective approaches to power are compatible, although we might perhaps differ on his relationship to authority. Jones' Dismissing Jesus I've not read. It too came out shortly before my own book was published, so I would not have been able to interact with him with my book in any event. One recent book that I did treat that came out about 4 years ago is Victor Lee Austin's Up With Authority. And it is such a significant book that I had to include it somehow in my own treatment of the subject. What is unique about this book is that in it, Austin affirms authority in the strongest, most positive way possible as something absolutely necessary for human flourishing. In fact, rather than limiting the possibilities lying before us, and I think many Westerners in particular tend to think of authority as something that is limiting, it's something that it constrains us, it's something that's potentially oppressive. But Austin affirms that authority actually opens up more possibilities for us than would otherwise exist. Orchestral music, for example, depends on the coordinating authority of the conductor. And without that conductor, the possibilities for instrumental music are severely limited. Where we would differ, however, where I think I would differ with Austin, is in his tendency to identify power and authority. I spend an entire chapter in my own book trying to refute that. Now, this isn't a major theme in Austin's book, but I think it's something that does need to be dealt with in some fashion.
This seems like a very simple question, but I think you have a way of clarifying these gigantic categories and perhaps making it accessible to those who are being introduced to these issues for the first time in a deeper level. But David, why is it important to flesh out the nature of authority, office, and the image of God?
It's important because I think it's key to understanding our humanity. Human beings are not autonomous. We tend to think in contemporary North America in particular, and perhaps this is true of Europe, far less so, I think, for the rest of the world, but we tend to think of authority as something that impinges on our humanity in some fashion. It limits us. It's oppressive. We tend to think that authority is somehow intrinsically oppressive and that somehow we need to get out from under authority to the extent possible. Liberalism, for example, is predicated on the idea that that human freedom is something that needs to be expanded at the expense of anything that might limit us from outside of our own subjective wills. But as a matter of fact, this is not a biblical understanding of humanity. The Bible affirms that we belong to God. We are utterly dependent on God, and there is no way that we can get beyond that. And we shouldn't want to get beyond that, because our dependence on God is the very condition for our humanity. It's the condition for our existence as those who are created in God's image. So authority is the defining feature of our humanity. We possess authority. We are given a grant of authority by God. And insofar as we are given authority, we are always under authority. And this is something that Austin says in his book. To possess authority is always to be under authority. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind as we think in a spiritually discerning way about the nature of authority and about office. Office is something that is granted to us as a kind of grant of responsibility. It is a calling, a specific calling that's related to something very specific within God's creation. So I have the calling of father, for example, to my daughter, and of husband to my wife. I have the calling of being an instructor in a university classroom. And none of these exhausts who I am as a human being created in God's image, but it is an office related to something quite specific. Now, there is the general office of image bearer of God, and I think all human beings possess that. And again, it's something that we have not claimed for ourselves. It's something that a gracious God has granted us.
David, is it safe to say that we are all under some authority, or as your title implies, we all answer to one another? I know there have been attempts to do away with authority structures. Can you just develop a little bit this theme of the necessity or the inescapability of authority in the life of human beings?
Yes. Yes, it's definitely safe to say that we are all under some authority. In fact, we cannot get out from under authority, no matter how hard we try. We are always answering to someone or something beyond ourselves and beyond our own wills. Everything that we do as those who are under authority. In the very first chapter of my book, I set out the story of a young man by the name of Michael. This is a completely fictitious person, but it's true to life all the same. And it begins like this. It is Monday morning. Michael, a third-year university student, is washed up, dressed himself, and headed out the door. He walks to the cafeteria a quarter of a mile away for breakfast. He joins two friends from his 9 o'clock class at the table, and afterwards they walk together to the building next door where the class will shortly begin. They arrive 5 minutes early but are unable to find seats because some of the chairs were removed the previous evening by the drama club. It just goes on like that, and it's very mundane, and when you look at it, there doesn't seem to be anything remarkable about it, and there really isn't. But then you have to ask the question, and this is something that I ask my students, where does authority enter into Michael's day as a university student? And people talk about the authority of the teacher, the instructor in the classroom, maybe the university administration. But when you look at this, in the very first sentence, you'll find that Michael is dependent on authority. So the very first thing I say is, it is Monday morning. Well, who decides that it's Monday morning? Not Michael, obviously. Not I as the author of this book. It's the not the university. Somebody, some system is set up in which the week is divided into 7 days, and it happens to be Monday morning. Michael is a third-year university student. What is the significance of being in one's third year of university? There's a whole curriculum that is set up and a whole series of requirements that are set up that Michael must meet in order to maintain his status as a third-year student at his university. He is washed, dressed himself, headed out the door. Once again, there are certain canons that he follows that prescribes that when he gets up in the morning, he should wash up, he should dress himself. He walks to the cafeteria a quarter of a mile away for breakfast. What is a mile? Who sets out the various weights and measures that we presuppose throughout the entire day? It's 9 o'clock. Again, there's a whole structure that divides our day into hours and minutes and seconds. And so everything we do, we are embedded into a whole variety of interlocking systems of authority. So we cannot escape that. Now, it is not to say that we have no initiative and we have no responsibility. Indeed, we do. But this responsibility is tantamount to what I am calling authority. Michael is under authority, but he possesses authority as well. So a little bit later in his day, he makes a call to his parents to tell him that he will not be returning to visit them for another weekend, because he has something else that's taking up another responsibility that he has to fulfill. Well, his parents say that's all right. They look forward to seeing him during his next visit. And what we see here is that Michael is not any more under immediate parental authority as he was a few years earlier. So he is developing his own authority. He is in charge of his own life in a way that he was not, say, 5 years beforehand when he was still living in his parents' home. So we are all under authority, but that doesn't mean that we possess authority any less.
The book describes various challenges to the concept of authority. You talk about this early in the book. And in particular, you refer to the Kantian challenge of authority as a formidable challenge. First of all, can you define what the Kantian challenge is and just elaborate, if you will, on that challenge?
Ah, yes, the Kantian challenge to authority. Yes, yes, indeed. It may be that all of us, insofar as we live in modern Western countries, are Kantians in some measure. The very nature of our human rights regime depends on this Kantian challenge to authority. And the Kantian challenge to authority is basically that insofar as we are mature adults, we do not simply accept directives based on authority, but we must measure every authoritative command that is issued to us in accordance with something that Kant calls the categorical imperative. We do not simply defer to authority when it tells us, for example, to drive on the right side of the road. Now, most of us in the real world, of course, those of us who live in right-driving countries such as Canada and the United States, automatically, when we turn out onto the street, we drive on the right side. If you live in Great Britain or Ireland or Cyprus or South Africa or some other country where they drive on the left, of course, that would be different. But the point is that from a Kantian perspective, you oughtn't to be doing that. Every time, presumably, you would be pulling out of the driveway, you need to think to yourself, well, why am I driving on the right side of the road? And then you engage in a certain intellectual exercise in which you think through the canon that tells us that we should be driving on one side of the road rather than the other. What would happen if I were to drive on the wrong side of the road? Well, then you reason there would be accidents, there would be hazards to public safety, and so forth, and you decide on the basis of this rational thinking through of this authoritative command that indeed I should drive on the right side of the road because it is in the interest of everybody. It is something that has universal applicability, that everybody is bound by this rule of the road that we should be driving on the right side. If I'm a good Kantian, then that's the way that I'm going to approach every dilemma that comes before me. I'm going to challenge that authority. You may have seen somebody walking around, usually I think it's a young man, walking around wearing a shirt that says, question authority. That's Kantian. That flows out of a Kantian notion. But if you think of that, the very way that challenge is posed to us, question authority, well, isn't that a command? Are we not being commanded to question authority? And if so, then maybe I need to, from a Kantian perspective, I need even to think through that particular maxim, question authority. Now, why should I question authority? Maybe I need to think through that as well. So the Kantian challenge tells us to question authority, but in the real world, there's no way that we can do that. We cannot simply question every authoritative precept that comes our way. Otherwise, the Kantian notion of the categorical imperative becomes incoherent. Why should I question authority? Why should I question every authoritative command? Well, I don't know how Kant would answer that, because I can't get into his shoes. But in any event, the categorical imperative does not work in the real world. A man by the name of Jonathan Haidt has recently written an excellent book called The Righteous Mind. And it's an excellent book because in it, Haidt successfully demonstrates that most people don't approach moral dilemmas on the basis of thinking through the dilemmas rationally and weighing the alternatives in the balance. The vast majority of people are going to approach moral dilemmas, and they will approach them intuitively. In other words, there's almost a split-second reaction to a dilemma in which people decide very quickly, and without rationally weighing the alternatives in the balance, they decide what's the right thing to do. Again, should we stop on the red light, and should we go on the green light? For most of us, it's a split second. It's maybe a nanosecond of an intuitive decision that we make, in which we decide what we're going to do at that particular instant. And indeed, we don't really have the time to think through every moral dilemma that comes our way. There's no way that we could spend maybe even 60 seconds or 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, thinking through every moral challenge that comes our way. Most of us, we have an intuitive sense of right and wrong, and we decide what we are going to do at the spur of the moment. So no, the Kantian challenge to authority is not a workable challenge. Of course, we would like people to think things through before they make decisions, and the hardest decisions, yes, indeed, we do have to think them through. We do have to come up with justifications for what we're going to do. A political decision making, in particular, we have parliamentary bodies set up so that our representatives, our deputies, our members of parliament, our members of Congress, will get together and deliberate about the great issues of the day, and think things through and come to decisions. But most decisions, whether to knock or ring the bell when we come to the door, whether to walk around the block as opposed to walk across the grass through the park, those are not decisions that we spend a great deal of time thinking about. Whether we ought to eat supper at 6 o'clock rather than at 10 o'clock, as some people do in Mediterranean climates, again, that's not something that we spend a lot of time thinking about. And we will indeed simply act on the basis of habit, to be sure. It's not simply irrational habit, but these are habits, hopefully good habits, that have been formed through the influence of our parents, our schools, our peers, our workplaces, through our churches, and a variety of other influences.
There's a very interesting section in the book where you talk about the allure of freedom. So freedom itself has been, of course, defined in various ways throughout history. But how should a Christian, David, think, or at least begin to think about freedom? Is there a more biblical school of thought that we should consider?
Yes, indeed, there is a more biblical school of thought. But let me talk about the allure of freedom to begin with. As human beings, we want to be free. We prefer to set our own course and to follow it as best we can, and we dislike having other people get in the way of that. We don't like to have our plans derailed. Freedom is simply attractive, and I think that's something which all of us can admit. Freedom has been defined in different ways throughout history. There is a famous distinction by Sir Isaiah Berlin between positive and negative freedom. Hannah Arendt makes a similar distinction. Negative freedom is freedom from something, freedom from various constraints that might get in the way of our fulfilling our desires. Then there's positive freedom, and positive freedom is the freedom to do something, the freedom to live our lives in a particular way. The freedom, from Hannah Arendt's perspective, the freedom to participate in public affairs, in the political life of action and speech amongst our fellow human beings. Freedom has indeed been defined in different ways throughout history, but as Christians, I think we have to look at freedom rather differently. In the Bible, in the book of John, Jesus famously says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Well, what does that mean? To begin with, God is the origin of truth. We are told in the Decalogue to avoid bearing false witness. That's another way of saying that we should not be lying. We should value the truth, and we should seek truth above all. That emphasis on freedom is carried forward in the epistles of Paul to the Romans, Galatians, and so forth, in which Paul emphasizes that as Christians we have freedom in Christ. And of course, that freedom is not the right simply to do whatever we want to, and that's something that Paul takes great pains to try to refute. His enemies apparently accused him simply of being a kind of antinomian, somebody who was a kind of libertine, as it were. And Paul says, no, that's not what we're free from. We are free from the minutiae of the Mosaic Law, to be sure, and the Mosaic Law was a marker of the identity of the people of God in the Old Covenant. But now we're in the New Covenant, and Christ has come, and Christ is the fulfillment of the law. It doesn't mean that we can do whatever we want to. It means that we now have the freedom to live for Christ, to live according to the law that He has given us, to live in accordance with the Spirit's leading, as He leads us into the ways of all truth. So freedom is something that's very much positive in the Bible. It's not the right to do whatever we want to. And increasingly nowadays, I think in our Western culture, we have tended to define freedom as simply the right to do whatever I want to. If somebody gets in the way of that, then we complain. We try to take action, whether it's political action or litigation, to try to get what we want to out of life. But no, the Bible has a quite different approach to freedom. We have the freedom to live in accordance with the Word of God, and freedom ultimately means freedom from sin. It means that we are free from the sin that weighs us down, from the sin that is an obstacle to our salvation. Jesus Christ has saved us, and that means that we have a very different understanding of freedom. What I am arguing in my book is that freedom is not different from authority, but freedom is a kind of authority, exclusive personal authority. So if I have freedom to decide whom to marry, to decide what to have for supper tonight, if I have the freedom to decide what career options to choose, then this is part and parcel of the grant of authority that I have as one made in the image of God.
Thank you, David. Very helpful. Of course, when we think about authority, immediately some people will think of the abuse of authority, which is so prevalent in our culture, and some of us have experienced firsthand. This is one reason many speak against the concept of authority. We live in a sinful world, granted, which means that people in authority positions will betray our trust. Ministers, fathers, leaders in the community will betray our trust. So how ought Christians to react to the abuse of authority? Do you propose a way of dealing with the abuse of authority in our society?
Oh, yes, the abuse of authority. We cannot talk about, well, we really can't talk about anything in God's world without talking about its abuse in some fashion, and that's true of authority. Authority, I am arguing in my book, is a grant is a grant to us by a gracious God, who has given authority because He loves us. But like every gift that God has given us, we abuse this gift of authority. We can't get around that. Yes, we do live in a sinful world, and everybody who has authority, people, which is everybody, we do live in a sinful world, which means that we abuse authority in a variety of ways. Now, how should we react to the abuse of authority? Well, in the first place, we need to remember that although authority is abused and is capable of being abused, authority is still the good gift of God. It's a creational reality. It's something that God has invested in us from the very beginning. Do I propose a way of dealing with the abuse of authority? Well, yes, but it's not just mine, my proposal. Because as a matter of fact, for centuries, especially Christians, but there's a larger tradition within the Western political tradition that, particularly within political context, that authority's abuse needs to be dealt with by what we might call checks on authority, or constitutional checks, if you will. Americans talk about the checks and balances that were invested in their Constitution by James Madison and John Jay and Alexander Hamilton and the other founders of the American Republic at the end of the 18th century. But it's not just the United States, it's not just the Americans, because here in Canada, where I live, in other Westminster democracies, such as those of New Zealand, Australia, the United Kingdom, there is something called responsible government, which means that the government of the day, the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, must maintain the confidence of Parliament, or Parliament's lower chamber, which we call the House of Commons, if they are to remain in authority, if they are to continue to exercise the authority of government. And if at any time the government does not command the authority of Parliament, then the Prime Minister must tender his government's resignation to the Queen's representative, the Governor General. And so there are any variety of ways in which the abuse of authority can be dealt with. Most organizations, I should think, if they're well constituted, will have some means of removing an official who has abused his authority, perhaps by a vote of the majority of members, or perhaps by the executive acting to check that abuse, perhaps punishing the abuse, or even as a last resort, removing that person from office. So yes, there are any number of ways in which the abuse of authority can be dealt with. At the very end of Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, in Book 4, Chapter 20, where he deals with the civil magistrate, Calvin has what seems like harsh words for those Christians living under tyrannical governments. And he says that perhaps we may need to view the tyrant as God's judgment on our disobedience. You know, that sounds fairly pessimistic. It sounds as though he's leaving people to suffer under tyranny. But he doesn't really do that, because at the very end, he raises the possibility of God raising up lower magistrates to remove a tyrant from his office. And so that's a possibility that Calvin holds out at the end of his Institutes for the Christian Religion. In other words, what Calvin is arguing in favor of is a constitutional check on the abuse of authority. And this is something that's followed through by Johannes Althusius, by Abraham Kuyper, and other people within the Reformed tradition as well. And it's not just the Reformed tradition, because Thomas Aquinas says something quite similar, that lower magistrates may be authorized, constitutionally authorized, in other words, through legal means, to check the power, the tyrannical power, of a chief magistrate.
Thank you, David, for that very rich discussion on the nature of power and its abuse, and really some very helpful historical applications for how we ought to, as Christians, look at the issue of the abuse of power. So thank you very much. David, one final question. Again, this is a wonderful book. It's entitled We Answer to Another, Authority, Office, and the Image of God. We're speaking of David Koizis. David, in closing, how ought the sovereignty of God, that is, the authority of the ascended Messiah, function in a pluralistic society, in a society where there are many authorities? How can the exhaustive claims the claims that our Dutch forefathers, such as Abraham Kuyper, claim, the exhaustive claims of Jesus function in a society that is pluralistic.
How ought the sovereignty of the ascended Messiah function in a pluralistic society? That's a very good question. By pluralism, I assume that you mean that we live in a society in which people worship different gods. They follow different ultimate pathways. St. Augustine spoke of the two cities, the city of God, which esteems God, loves God above everything he has created, and the city of this world, which is made up of those who love the things that God has created over God himself, and they may even deny God's sovereignty. I think in the first place, we need to affirm that no matter whether we human beings acknowledge him to be sovereign, God is nevertheless still sovereign. So there's a sense in which no matter what we do, even as political actors, God remains sovereign. And Jesus Christ is the king of all the earth, as affirmed in Psalm 47. The use of royal metaphors for Jesus Christ in the scripture, I think, is striking. God in Christ is king of the whole earth. Now, some Christians, Reformed Christians in particular, have interpreted this to mean that maybe we ought to seek to amend our constitutional documents so that they explicitly acknowledge the kingship of Christ. Here in Canada, our Charter of Rights and Freedoms makes a reference to God, which the American Constitution, interestingly enough, does not. Even though Canada, in many respects, is more of a post-Christian society than the United States is. But the sovereignty of the ascended Messiah, I think that in everything that we do, that includes political life, it includes our life in family, it includes life within our cities, within our communities, our neighborhoods, within the arts, in everything that we could possibly engage in as culture-shaping image bearers of God, we do so as agents of the kingdom of Christ, the agents of God's coming kingdom, which is at once here but not yet present in its fullness. I think we have every confidence that as we go about living our lives, that God will ultimately bless our efforts in behalf of his kingdom. We don't know how that will occur. We don't know how that will happen. I think we have to maintain a certain humility in the face of the unbelief in our society. We know that God is patient with unbelief in the present age, and we dare not try to judge that unbelief now before the return of Christ. We do know that when Christ returns, that there will be a final judgment. But that final judgment, of course, is not the same as our own fallible efforts at bringing about justice within our earthly political communities. But insofar as we bring about some of God's justice, approximate justice, as one observer has called it, we have every confidence that God will bring his kingdom to fruition in the new heaven and the new earth, and that's when his justice will finally come about.
David Koizies is the author of We Answer to Another, Authority, Office, and the Image of God. David, thank you for your labors and for taking your time to speak with us at Trinity Talk.
Oh, you're very welcome, Yuri. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.